You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Last week at our CSIS Brookings event on cross-strait relations, Ambassador Raymond Burkhart, the chairman of the American Institute in Taiwan, noted that the defense relationship between the United States and Taiwan is much broader and deeper than what one reads about in the newspapers, in the media. And I think what we learned today about the collaborative process on asymmetric and innovative capabilities is an example of that breadth and depth. So now we're going to drill down a little more on the Quadrennial Defense Review for 2013 itself. And for that, we have two real experts. Colonel Chun Jia-sheng will make a presentation. Colonel Chun is the director of the Defense Net Assessment Division of the Department of Integrated Assessment in the ROC's Ministry of National Defense, and that really is the department that puts the QDR together. After he's finished with his PowerPoint presentation, we will then assemble here, and we'll be joined by Dr. Phil Saunders, who is the director of the Center for the Study of Chinese Military Power at the Institute for National Security Studies at National Defense University. And then we'll have some time for questions. So, Colonel Chun, I ask you to come on up.
Thank you, Chairman, for your introduction. Distinguished scholars from Brookings and CSIS, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Colonel Chun. Chairman has already introduced me, so I just skip this part. I'm really honored to have this opportunity to review our 2013 QDR. And there are five parts of this briefing shown as on the table. The first one, introduction. The Ministry of National Defense, in compliance with Article 31 of the National Defense Act, is required to submit a quadrennial defense review to the Legislative Yuan within 10 months after each presidential inauguration. The promulgation of our second QDR on March 13 this year manifest that we have built a four-year defense review mechanism to realize the president's strategic concepts, review existing defense policy, incorporate suggestions from all realms, reflect public opinions and expectations, propose implementation plans for defense policy, and propose and outline the directions for military development, and also promote the communication with the Legislative Yuan to strive for the support for defense policy. Now, the compilation of the QDR. During the compilation of the QDR, the Ministry of National Defense engaged all of its staff units, responsible agencies, and civilian experts and scholars on areas such as defense strategy, security studies, and international laws in a total of 36 meetings in response to future security environment and defense needs. The Ministry of National Defense incorporated ideas of all participants to make the QDR more comprehensive. The framework of the QDR. The 2013 QDR is based upon President Ma's concept of three legs of national security. The national development vision of the golden decade and the guidance of conquer the enemy by strategy. The QDR aims to consolidate defense consensus and specify the defense strategy and force development directions to respond to changes in international security environment in consideration of available defense resources and focusing on the innovative asymmetric concepts. The following are the key points of each chapter. Chapter 1, Security Situation and National Defense Challenges. The Asia-Pacific security environment has undergone several changes over the past 4 years. Five aspects are identified as follows. First, rapid growth of mainland China's power. Mainland China's military modernization has progressed rapidly. Its force projection capabilities have extended over the first island chain to the Pacific, gradually changing the Asia-Pacific balance of power. It is actively developing the anti-access and area denial capabilities to threaten U.S. power projection and freedom of maneuver in this region. Second, U.S. Asia-Pacific strategic adjustment. The U.S. is adopting a rebalanced strategy to utilize the combined strength of friendly and allied countries to ensure their common interests are not threatened by any individual country, thereby maintain regional security and stability. The third, sovereignty claims over dispute, island and maritime rights interests. The tension in the Asia-Pacific region has recently escalated due to sovereignty claims over disputed island and maritime rights and interests. The disputes over the Diao Yitai Island and islands in the South China Sea involve the most complex issues and impact the regional peace and stability, and also the ROC nation's defense and security. The fourth, Northeast Asia issues. The Korean Peninsula remains the most unstable factors in the Northeast Asia. Until now, North Korea has been developing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, causing turbulence in this region. After the leadership transition in North Korea, its military and diplomatic policies become increasingly assertive. Its third nuclear test has attracted international condemnation, making the resumption of the six-party talks more difficult and bringing greater uncertainty to the Korean Peninsula. The fifth, non-traditional security threats. Non-traditional security threats are comparable to traditional security threats and may result in complex disasters which pose a major threat to the sustainable development of regional countries. In terms of security development in the Taiwan Strait, the following points are identified. Number one, relaxation of cross-trade relations. Over the past 4 years, both sides of the Taiwan Strait have resumed institutionalized talks and are gradually heading toward rapprochement. Second, mainland China's military strategy against Taiwan. Cross-trade rapprochement does not stop our endeavor to modernize our defense capability. China has never renounced the use of force against Taiwan, and the People's Liberation Army continue to build up military force and plans in attempt to seize Taiwan. The goal of the military exercise is to rapidly end an island conflict and reduce the possibility of foreign intervention. The third, the current military threat posed by mainland China. The PLA has expanded its ISR coverage to the entire area west of the first island chain, and its tactical ballistic missiles and cruise missiles are all capable of reaching Taiwan. In addition, it is accelerating the development of its fourth-generation fighters and carrier-based fighters, blue water naval capability, amphibious warfighting capacity, and information operations and electronic warfare, making it a major military threat to us. As for domestic security environment challenges, 5 points are regarded as significant. The first, defense resource constraints. Defense resources are becoming more and more constrained. Consequently, benefits and welfare packages for military personnel can now be significantly improved, resulting in the lack of incentive for recruits and retention, and increasing the difficulties in promoting voluntarism. Second, low birth rate. Given the decreasing number of able-bodied male in Taiwan, the Ministry of National Defense needs to reduce force level accordingly and improve military personnel's quality and professional ability to meet defense requirements. The third, disaster prevention and relief. Disaster prevention and relief has been tasked as one of the ROC Armed Forces core missions. In addition, carrying out a regular military exercise, active duty and reserve forces help to strengthen their disaster relief capabilities. The fourth, cybersecurity. During peacetime, potential enemies may steal, alter, and remove our online information. Once a conflict starts, enemies may disable our command, control, and logistics networks through cyber attacks. Hence, the ROC Armed Forces must strengthen their response capabilities. The fifth, challenge of defense awareness. The public has been living in peace and prosperity that are gradually neglecting threats and surrounding security issues. In light of the military threats posed by mainland China, we must improve the awareness of counterintelligence activities and increase the public's threat awareness. Chapter 2. National Defense Policy and Strategic Guidance. First of all, National Defense Policy, considering development of the current security environment, the ROC Armed Forces continue to implement military preparation based on the President's guidance of building a hard rock defense force. On this basis, the Ministry of National Defense reiterates 7 objectives at the current stage. They are building credible capabilities, demonstrating defense resolution, safeguarding regional stability, strengthening intangible combat capability, enhancing disaster prevention and relief preparedness, promoting voluntarism, and improving welfare for military personnel and their dependents. As for national defense strategy, 5 components are as follows. Number 1, war prevention. The armed forces exert their efforts to strengthen defense preparation and combat readiness, promote regional military security exchanges and cooperation, and consolidate the national defense power to prevent threats from other countries. Number 2, homeland defense. We continue to build an elite armed force, establish high effective joint operation capabilities, acquire modernized weapons, and accumulate all our defense capabilities to effectively safeguard homeland and sovereignty. Number 3, contingency response. The ROC Armed Forces will properly respond to contingency by refining the surveillance, reconnaissance, and early warning capabilities. perfecting contingency response mechanism, enhancing contingency operation capabilities, improving disaster prevention and relief capabilities, and also reinforcing information security. Number four, conflict avoidance. The ROC Armed Forces will implement military conflict avoidance measures to reduce distrust, misjudgment, and misunderstanding, and strictly abide by conflict avoidance regulations to avoid conflict caused by miscalculation. Number five, regional stability. The ROC Armed Forces will also maintain peace and security of the Asia-Pacific region, jointly safeguard air and maritime security in the East and South China Seas and in areas surrounding Taiwan, and participate in international anti-terrorism and humanitarian assistance activities. Moreover, we commit to international norms, uphold the principle of not producing, not developing, not acquiring, not storing, and not using nuclear weapons, and strictly abide by the regulations controlling the export of weapons to improve the peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific region. Under the guidance of the defense strategy, the ROC Armed Forces have adopted resolute defense, credible deterrence as the military strategy concept. To implement the above-mentioned concept, the ROC Armed Forces must effectively carry out the following five missions. Number one, resolute defense to ensure the security of national territory. Number two, credible deterrence to decrease the intention of enemy invasion. Number three, counter-blockade to maintain sea and air lines of communication. Number four, joint interdiction to delay the enemy from approaching the homeland. Number five, ground defense to deny enemy landing and setting footholds. Chapter three, joint warfighting capabilities and preparedness laid out five dimensions. First of all, manned warfighting capabilities. Joint counter-air capability is to establish early detection and warning, long-range precision engagement, and joint multi-layer interdiction capabilities to obtain air superiority in designated airspace. Number two, joint sea control capabilities aims to establish high quality and efficient rapid deployment and a long-range strike capabilities to deter enemies' incursion, defend the sovereignty over islands and maritime rights and interests, and ensure the security of sea and air lines of communications, and ensure as well as freedom of maneuver. Number three, joint ground defense capabilities focus on establishing three-dimensional, digitized, automated, and special operation ground combat capabilities in accordance with the concept of active duty force for strike and attack, reserve force for homeland defense, to ensure the safety of region, bases, and facilities. In terms of support capabilities, two major parts have to be taken care of. Number one, joint C4ISR capabilities. This is aiming to gain real-time battlefield information by constructing a network system and integrating command and control centers, weapon platforms, and surveillance systems. Number two, joint information operation and electronic warfare. This is to establish early warning, rapid response, effective countermeasures, and delaying enemy attack capabilities so as to ensure our information operations and electronic warfare capabilities and superiority. In addition to the man and support capabilities, the following four aspects are also essential. Logistics and readiness. The armed forces emphasize on building capabilities of precise logistics management and rapid logistics support to integrate the logistics capability of each service. As for reserve mobilization part, the armed forces will refine mobilization policy, effective integrate administration system, and properly utilize national resources to establish timely mobilization and engagement and on-site mobilization and engagement capabilities. In terms of joint disaster relief, the armed forces adopts the measures of preparing for disasters in advance, deploying troops with an eye to disaster preparedness, and ensuring readiness for rescue operations to complete personnel and supply mobilization and provide support to local government for disaster prevention and relief, to ensure the nation's overall disaster prevention and relief capabilities. The last portion of this chapter is the overall intangible combat capabilities. This aims to build robust intangible combat capabilities to solidify national identity, cultivate patriotic integrity, counter enemies' psychological warfare, consolidate the will to win, and establish all-out defense. The last chapter of the 23rd QDI is defense organization and transformation. The first is associated with organizational structure. Three key points are as follows. Number one, refined planning mechanism for force building. The Ministry of National Defense now is replacing balanced force buildup with mission-oriented, prioritized force buildup. Defense resources and allocation will concentrate on building strategically sustainable joint operational forces. Number two, streamline the defense organization. The Ministry of National Defense adjusts its organizational structure to establish a defense organization capable of meeting requirements for future warfare. Number three, building a suitable force based upon the enemy threat, national security situation, the overall resource allocation, and the idea of combat, equipment, organization, and training. The Ministry of National Defense will build joint forces suitable for future operation environment. At the current stage, the Ministry of National Defense is implementing the Jingchui program. The force level of the ROC armed forces will be reduced to 215,000 by the end of 2014. The Ministry of National Defense will continue to research and adjust the force structure in the near future. As for resource management, four components are as follows. First, refined armaments management. This aspect is to combine the national economic development and civilian power to promote technique transfer, research and development, production and maintenance to support force buildup and various missions. Second, maximize the usage of defense resources. Future defense budgetary allocation will be based on the concept of zero-based budget and the procedure of planning, programming, and budgeting system, or PPBS. Administrative requirements and program priorities will be comprehensively reviewed to maximize the cost effectiveness of the limited financial resources. The third, combine defense and civilian needs. This is to develop a self-reliant and defense industry, design military civilian dual-use technologies, expand defense outsourcing, and enhance overall military-based usage to enhance dual values of strengthening defense and facilitating economy. Fourth, step up defense talent cultivation. Talent cultivation in the ROC emphasis is purpose-oriented and plan-based. In the future, the Ministry of National Defense will continue to cultivate defense professionals for force build-up and military preparation based on requirements for defense transformation. In light of warfighting capacity, three dimensions need our attention. First of all, promote voluntarism under the presupposition of ensuring defense security and maintaining military obligation as stipulated in the Constitution. The Ministry of National Defense now is promoting voluntarism and implementing various complementary measures to strengthen weaponry and equipment readiness and troop training. Second, integrate joint operations capacity. This is to perfect a joint warfighting command mechanism in order to make the mechanism function both during wartime and peacetime with coherent authority and fully exert command and control effectiveness of the joint operations. The third, build an all-out defense consensus. The Ministry of National Defense will coordinate interagency efforts and combine the capacity of government agencies and social resources to promote all-out defense to gain the public support for defense development. The last part, conclusion. In response to changes of the current security environment and challenges to our national defense, the Ministry of National Defense will continue to promote defense transformation and military preparedness to ensure that all goals elaborated in the QDR will be achieved with quality and in a timely manner. By doing so, we'll make the ROC Armed Forces a small but superb, small but strong, small but smart elite force, capable of supporting cross-strait peaceful engagement, ensuring cross-strait security, and maintaining regional stability. This is the end of the briefing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Colonel Chun. And now we turn to Phil Saunders, who can speak from his seat or speak at the podium, whatever you want.
I'll go ahead and speak from here. I'm going to do three things. I'll talk a little bit about the QDR process and the QDR as a document. I want to talk very briefly about the logic underpinning Taiwan's efforts to deter an attack from the mainland, and then I'll speak to couple specific points in the QDR. And the first is this is a really serious effort. This is not something tossed off or done in a slipshod manner. There's a lot of good analysis here. There's a lot of hard work here. I went through the description of the security environment, and I found myself struck by what an honest and comprehensive assessment it really is. And I went through and I only found one thing that I disagreed with, and we think it's a translation issue. On page 21, the document says that the PLAN possesses the ability to impose a partial blockade on Taiwan. I think that's true. And to conduct anti-access area denial operations in certain areas, quote, which can deny U.S. intervention in the Taiwan Strait. And I don't think that is the case. Although as we looked into this, the Chinese makes clear that this is an aspirational capability, something that the PLA Navy is trying to develop, but I don't think they have it now. Part of the game when the U.S. does QDRs or any strategic document is everybody wants to make sure there's some language in there that supports their own particular programs, their own particular systems, their pet priorities and programs. And I see that, and that's sometimes a weakness, that you have a strategic document that's a consensus document and it covers everybody's particular pet interests, and it winds up not setting as clear priorities as you might want. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But this one, I think, does have a very frank assessment of the security environment, the threat posed by the PRC and what the PLA military is doing, the ways that environment is changing, and the challenges Taiwan faces in dealing with that. It also has a frank assessment of the things Taiwan can do, and there's lots and lots of good ideas in here, especially in the area of innovative and asymmetrical approaches, which are things that are affordable for Taiwan, that things that Taiwan can often do using its own resources and its own defense industry with a little bit of outside help, and that I will argue really could make a strategic difference. Just to come through on that point, I had the good fortune to travel to Taiwan with Richard Bush on a Brookings delegation and talk to a number of the drafters of the QDR and a number of people in the national security establishment in Taiwan. And I came away from that trip with a good sense of what is the real thinking there about deterrence. And a lot of that is reflected in the report, but there's one or two elements that are not. So let me try to sketch that very quickly. I think one piece is good relations with the mainland. This increases the actors in the PRC who have a stake in good, peaceful cross-strait relations because they're making money or they're benefiting in various ways. It also provides Beijing with the hope that someday there could be peaceful unification if the PRC is persuasive enough. So I think that good cross-strait relations is part of the deterrence calculus because it raises the cost of the PRC using force and it provides at least the hope of an alternative way for Beijing to get what it wants without using force. I think the second piece, pretty clearly, is not providing the PRC with an excuse to use force, not providing anything that Beijing can point to that justifies this, because an unprovoked attack by China would greatly raise the international costs of a PRC use of force. And I think that's part of the Taiwan deterrence calculus. And I think the QDR speaks to that, in particular when it talks to the part about conflict avoidance through a variety of means to make sure that the Taiwan military is not the one accidentally setting off a conflict. And those things make a great deal of sense. Taiwan, I know, has tight rules of engagement and very effective command and control. So I think that's a second piece, not providing an excuse. A third piece is to keep the possibility of outside military intervention alive, something that PRC planners, PLA planners and PRC leaders have to keep in mind. Part of that is having a good political relationship with the United States, which is one of the few countries that has the military capability to intervene. And part of it is Taiwan having its own military capabilities to hold out long enough for the United States to get there. And the political part requires Taiwan to be seen to be doing enough for its own defense. Not only that it can hold out, but that it's committed to its own defense. And I think that's a politically important part. And that means that PRC leaders and PLA planners have to plan in the possibility of U.S. intervention. And that greatly raises the costs and risks of conflict. And then finally is Taiwan's own military capabilities, the things it can do to raise the costs and risks of a PRC blockade or invasion. So let me turn to the third part and talk a little bit about how the QDR speaks to these in this kind of deterrence framework. One thing I think it's very clear about what the main military threat is. It says it's the PRC, it says that flatly, and that's what the military has to plan against. And it talks about a variety of things that the Taiwan military can do. One thing I noticed, though, is it also talks about a range of other diversified security challenges, including threats to Taiwan's sovereignty over islands in the South China Sea, the need to be prepared for disaster relief, both on the island and off, and the need for protection of sea lanes and counter-blockade operations. And I think there, one of the concerns that I have is the potential for a loss of focus, trying to do too many missions with limited resources. I think the document is very smart in thinking about the ways in which disaster relief, which, as Andrew knows because we've done some things together, there's always natural disasters happening in Taiwan, and the military plays an important role in responding to them. And I think it's smart in thinking about how you can use that to test your mobilization capability, your command and control, to build support for defense spending, and in that sense, it's politically astute. But again, I see these diversified missions and the potential for a loss of focus. A second thing is the focus on survivability, hardening, mobility, resilience. All of these important for the Taiwan to have the ability to hold out long enough for the United States to intervene. I'll make the point that this needs training to be effective. It's not enough just to have missiles that you can move around. You have to practice that. You have to train doing that. And I think there's a lot of specific recommendations in the report for ways of increasing the mobility, the hardening, the resilience, and the survivability of the force. Those are really important to contribute to deterrence. There is, as has been said by Deputy Minister Yang by the presentation, a lot of emphasis on asymmetrical and innovative approaches, a number of things specifically identified in the report, including mine capability, including cruise missiles, including multiple rocket launchers, a number of things, good ideas that I think can be implemented. For reasons of security, they're not fully spelled out in an unclassified report, but a lot of good ideas there that reflect hard thinking in the Taiwan military, good modeling to really explore these things, and I think good advice from the United States and U.S. experts. But I also note there's also calls in there for a range of conventional systems, and I just was doing a little math, but new fighters, new ships, new submarines, a new type of tank, a whole range of conventional systems. And this may be the QDR syndrome of every service needs to get its priority into the document, but to me it raises the question of how are you going to spend your limited resources to get the most bang for the buck? What's the relative priority of acquisitions, and will they be funded? Another thing that was mentioned in the presentation is the focus on the potential role of the Taiwan defense industry in meeting some of these challenges, ways things can be done with dual-use technology, technologies that Taiwan can build itself, and the document says that ought to be the first priority if we can do it here. And I think that makes sense in terms of a self-reliant Taiwan, but also one where there is a defense industry which is creating jobs in districts of which there are legislative yuan members. So I think that's also speaking to sort of the political foundations of defense spending, which I think this report does think about. But this brings me to the last question. I think it's long been a perception and to some degree a frustration of U.S. defense officials that a lot of the thinking in Taiwan is focused on purchases of high-end U.S. systems, that's not only the answer in terms of building Taiwan defense capability, but it's also a political symbol of U.S. support. And that sometimes has meant that there's a focus on F-16s or some particular system which is seen as the answer. And I think you can make a case that these asymmetrical, innovative approaches can also be thought of as strategic systems. They have the potential to raise military questions that the PLA doesn't have good answers for. And I think that's the mental picture we want to have when PRC civilian officials are thinking, well, should we use force or not against Taiwan? If they can ask PLA planners, well, how are you going to deal with those multiple rocket ships, multiple rocket launchers? Can you really clear the minefield? How are you going to have the sea lift to get all the way across the Taiwan Strait with a Taiwan military that can shoot at you every step of the way? These are strategic questions. And it's been, I think, a frustration of U.S. defense officials that sometimes the message we hear from Taiwan is, well, if you only agree to sell us this system, the legislature will find the money, we'll do a special budget, and we'll add defense resources. I think for some of these asymmetrical approaches, you need to have the same mindset. These are things that could be game changers, that really could be strategic systems that contribute greatly to Taiwan's defense and deterrence of an attack, which rightly is at the foundation of your strategy. So think about, I think, not just Andrew, who I know has thought long and hard about this, but these are questions for political leaders, both in the executive branch and in the legislative yuan, to think about how they can fund things that really will make a big difference for Taiwan's security and contributing to stable, effective deterrence for a long time to come.
Thanks to both Colonel Chun and Phil Saunders for those thoughtful and comprehensive presentations. Andrew has joined us on the at the podium or at the table here. Do you have some immediate comments you'd like to make? You don't have to, but...
I just want to say Phil's recommendation, suggestions, you know, it's very much our current approach. And I think that you will see more in the near future that, that we are making our efforts to cope with some of the issues you raised in your remarks. Thank you.
In a previous job, I was involved tangentially in the production of the first U.S. QDR, and I can attest to the fact that these are not easy to do. Particularly, they're not easy if it's a new item on the agenda of a defense establishment, because every part of that defense establishment is worried about protecting its equities in the text, as Phil suggested. And so I think the progress that has been made from the first Taiwan QDR to the second one is worthy of note. So now we have about 25 minutes for questions from you. And as before, please wait for the mic, then identify yourself. And if there's a particular person on the panel you have a question for, please note that. So I saw the gentleman right here first, and then we'll go to Eric.
Thank you. Akira Chiba of the Japanese Embassy. My question for Dr. Chen is a hypothetical one. Concerning the island issue mentioned in relationship with Japan, suppose Tokyo agrees to Taipei's viewpoint, and suppose Tokyo hands over the islands to Taipei, what do you think would be the reaction from Beijing? Would they commend Taipei for recovering territory, or would they just send PLA vessels and take it from Taipei, in which case, what is your defense plan?
Anybody want to answer that question?
The lead to, it would be very difficult for Colonel Chan to ask these highly sensitive political questions. Well, this is my personal view. I think it would be wise for Beijing leader to keep quiet or to be mute about this handover of the Daoyutai to ROC's domain. I think that the less they say about anything about it, the better.
Yeah. I would only add that as a congressional staffer and a diplomat, I learned you never answer hypothetical questions. So Andrew is more courageous than I was. Eric McFadden.
Yes, Eric McFadden, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Phil, you brought up the issue about on page 21. I have to confess I haven't read the QDR, so I don't know if it covers it elsewhere. I would have had further objections. You said it, that the U.S. Would not, or that it needed to, that there was a threat to U.S. intervention against an invasion or a blockade, and mentioned specifically the Taiwan Strait. I'd broaden both of those and say an attack on Taiwan, and, of course, a Taiwan conflict or a broader area. What I mean by this, for example, is if you're going to specify something like a blockade, I think it is just as feasible to look at the threat and directly address it and realize you have to deter it of an attack that consists of ballistic and cruise missiles and cyber warfare and so forth that might not include an invasion. So I'm suggesting when you are attempting to deter something, it is appropriate to define it carefully, and maybe that I would have raised that objection to the wording you mentioned.
I agree.
Any other comment? Next question. Back there.
Jeffrey Lin. I'm a student with George Washington University right now. So my question essentially is concerning how much room would the Taiwanese budget have in the future to expand? Because obviously the reforms proposed in the QDR, namely volunteerism and the asymmetric capabilities, they can't be cheap. And, well, by some estimates, the PLA now spends more per soldier than the ROC military does per soldier by some estimates. So how can Taiwan work to sort of address not only a quantitative but also a financial disadvantage?
Well, in terms of defense modernization and defense transformation, everybody knows it's not coming cheap. But I have to emphasize one thing is that, as I mentioned earlier, that we're not competing with Beijing in terms of military balance or any military build-up here. What we are focusing on is to strengthening our self-defense and defense transformation in accordance with our own plan. So I think that with regard to resources allocation, certainly we are asking adequate and sufficient input to support our program and also enable the ministry to implement the current all-volunteer system and to make our future young generation who join the armed forces with the kind of professionalism we are expecting them to develop.
Any other comments? Phil.
And I should just add that I am speaking in a scholarly capacity, so these are not U.S. government views. I think there are challenges for Taiwan to spend enough on defense, and I'm not personally sure that they're currently doing that. That is part of keeping the possibility of U.S. intervention alive, that if Taiwan is not doing enough for its own defense, I think that has a corrosive effect on its support here in Washington. So it's important to do that. And then the second challenge is to make sure that the funds you do have availability, you're spending on the right things that really produce the most strategic effect in terms of capability and in terms of deterrence. And I think the QDR was an effort to think that through. As I suggested, it includes a lot of things in here that would be very smart uses of defense money. It includes other things that seem to me would be a challenge to be affordable.
Phil, you'd agree that all of your remarks were your personal views?
Yes.
Okay. I would just add that one theme that runs through the QDR that I was struck by is the observation that within the Taiwan public there's a certain complacency about the nature of the threat environment and the need to do public education that is balanced and realistic about the challenges that Taiwan faces and perhaps change the political environment from which budgets emerge. Who has the next question? We'll go here and then here.
Stan Weeks, Naval War College. My question's for Andrew. We've had a number of missions in the maritime area mentioned here, counter-blockade, sea lane protection, surveillance. You were instrumental last year in reestablishing a Central Taiwan role in the International Sea Lane Study Group and hopefully institutionalizing that. So I'd like to just, if you could, give us a brief perspective on how you see the development of Taiwan's naval forces. And secondly, given that some of your maritime forces, of course, are not under your ministry, how you see the state of cooperation with the Taiwanese Coast Guard.
I think that the first question is that it's briefly mentioned in line with the QDR report, is that we are focusing on developing the naval force in terms of can simultaneously conducting our joint war fighting capabilities to deter the enemy's threats to conduct amphibious landing operations. I think that's important. So we are having a very clear mission for the future naval operations as well. So the developments in terms of acquisition or the training will be focusing in that regard. Secondly, we are working very closely with the Coast Guard units, not only in terms of protecting our fishery, but also in terms of regulating the maritime regions, which is part of our sovereignty defined by the our maritime policies as well. As currently, we have conducted very close collaboration in terms of protecting our fishery activities surrounding Taiwan and even including some of the areas near Senkaku and Dawei Islands. Same goes for the activities to cope with our Spratly Islands position there. And there was a unit, there's a unit set up by the Coast Guards to regulate the Spratlys. And we conduct our regular supply missions to support the Coast Guard units on the island as well. So Navy and the Coast Guards are working very closely together.
Gentleman right here.
Yes, gentlemen, Byron Callen, Capital Alpha Partners. I wonder if you can talk a little about the institutions to promote asymmetric capabilities, innovation in Taiwan. In the United States, we think of DARPA and the Department of Defense and the engagement in maybe smaller, more innovative companies, General Atomics in drones, for example, and the rise of that capability. So do you have the existing institutions in place to push this forward? You need to create new institutions within Taiwan.
Well, the institutional arrangements to promote asymmetrical capability is very much a responsibility of the Department of Integrated Assessments. We call it DIA. It's not a U.S. DIA. It's our DIA. And the director of the DIA is sitting next to you, actually. So his department is the sole responsible agencies to implement and to facilitate asymmetrical capability building. And in addition, we have a defense think tank attached to the DIA, and it will be a linkage to integrated efforts from our side, particularly with regard to the academic or debates to come up with better ideas to reinforce our asymmetrical capability.
Hello, I'm Chantel Frazier from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Colonel Chin mentioned the low birth rate being a particular challenge for Taiwan. I wanted to know if you could speak a little bit more about how that factors into your defense strategy and what Taiwan is doing to face this issue of the changing population demographics.
Well, the demographic changes in Taiwan, it's a long-term concern for our volunteer system in terms of, particularly with regard to recruitment, because you have smaller, new young generational populations in the future, and you're facing more steep competition with the private sectors. And so you're probably facing less and less willingness to join the armed forces. So it will be a challenge for our selections. So we are looking at the demographic changes in that respect, because you have fewer younger generations population in the future. So making your selection more difficult. So that's the aspect we are addressing.
Yes, the gentleman back there.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm Liu Zongyi from Shanghai Institute for International Studies. Now, I'm a visiting fellow in CSIS. Taiwan is not my focus, but I'm wondering if Vietnam invade Taiping Island in South China Sea, what's the reaction of Taiwan? Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'll follow Richard's advice. I will not answer the hypothetical question this time. Yes.
And worst case questions, too.
Yes.
Richard Chin. And then we'll come here.
This is follow up on Richard Bush's comment about how the QDR is stressing, you know, public awareness and trying to build a consensus for support for military spending and preparedness against the People's Republic of China. So the question is, you know, it mentions specifically a few items about media and other things, and I was wondering how much budget you have set aside, really, and what type of mechanism have you put in place to go out and do this public opinion warfare. And second question related to that is PRC doing anything to counter that? That is, you know, trying to, I mean, obviously the economic relation and the integration is going to cause a lot of public sentiment to be less or become more complacent. And so the question is, you know, how do you balance that and how do you fight that?
Well, our effort is to provide the evidence or the proof to our domestic audiences, so that they can come up with a better interpretation about the efforts we made, and certainly supporting our efforts. I think the priority goes for the solidarity. So once we can achieve confidence and solidarity and support from our domestic societies and constituencies, I think that would be a very important and strong deterrence towards the psychological intimidation launched by the other side. It's difficult to calculate how much resources or budget being allocated into it, but I think that once you achieve more solidarity and confidence in your own indigenous efforts, then you will create a more stable society and more stable economy in that regard.
Okay. You want to have a follow-up?
It seems that the premise is that if you show China's aggression and potentially, you know, threat, that the people will come together and become supportive. But that's where I am a little bit, I have a little doubt. That is, you know, the more threat that China has, the people may turn the other way. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, what is the message that you're sending out to the public rather than just saying that China is a threat and they really have an intention to invade us. Versus, you know, what is the consequence to the public of that invasion? Are you going to be better off or worse off, and for what reason or how? And so I was trying to, you know, get us that kind of sense.
Well, if you face that kind of worst-case scenario, I mean, the only concern is your own survival. So I think that everybody has worked together. Unless you united everybody together and to find a way to support your own survival, you have no other options. So I think that the public will come up with a consensus to support that effort.
Add to that, and part of the reason I spoke a little bit about the broader pieces of deterrence, including the efforts to engage the mainland and improve ties there, is I think they are related. And what Taiwan does to maintain its own military security and raise the costs of using force, I think strengthens the Taiwan leadership's hand in dealing with the mainland. So it is, there is a tension there between saying we want to have better relations with the mainland, but we also need to prepare. But I think that's an apparent tension. If you think about it with all the aspects, it does make a lot of sense, and there is a relationship to how those things hang together. It's sometimes a challenge to explain it to the general public, though.
Gentleman right here.
Thank you. My question is for Mr. Yang. I'm Roland Coleman from American Enterprise Institute. My question is regarding the intangible combat initiatives, developing a strong national identity. What concerns or issues do you foresee in developing that national identity without provoking a negative response from the mainland?
I think we already are making efforts to educate or to provide the foundation for the constituencies in general public to see the future lies in the efforts to support the constitutional arrangements for our country. I think that identity has to be closely attached to the constitutional framework, abiding by the due process. And I think that that requires a lot of efforts through education as well. So I think in broader sense, the more stronger consensus to reinforce the constitutional identity, the better for the management of the stability and peace in the Taiwan Strait area. That's our strongest buffer of protection.
One last question. Richard Fisher, I was waiting for you to raise your hand, Rick.
Thank you, Richard, and thanks to all the panelists for this very interesting discussion. I'd just like to tempt the minister with a nicer hypothetical question. At the end of the recent U.S.-Philippine Balikatan exercise, there was a conference on responding to disaster relief at Camp Aguinaldo, and it's my understanding that the PLA sent representatives. In the next RIMPAC exercise, there's also a disaster relief event, perhaps a conference, I'm not sure what, but it's my understanding that PLA is also invited. Taiwan, as we know, has had has earned at great cost an enviable reputation in the area of responding to disaster relief. Has Taiwan been invited to participate in future conferences of this manner for disaster relief, or would Taiwan welcome such an invitation to participate in these conferences, even if it was at a suboptimal level of, let's say, an NGO? Thank you.
Well, I haven't got any information about the invitation in the first place, so I can answer your question whether we've been invited or not. But I think it's been clearly described in our QDR report that we are committed to strengthen the efforts of disaster relief operations. Actually, we demonstrated we possess the capability and experiences of disaster and humanitarian relief operations in the past. So I think that given the policy and based upon the experiences we accumulated, we certainly hope that we have the opportunity to participate in the international joint efforts of any disaster relief operation in the future. That is part of our contribution to the community and to the region as well. That also demonstrating our desire and the ability to provide our contribution to whoever it needs. This is not an issue of for political cultivation or making political advantages. It's pretty much based upon the common values that everybody should share with each other.
On that note, I think we'll bring this to a close. I want to thank several people. First of all, the folks on my staff, Kevin, Aileen, and Jennifer. Kevin, in particular, did a lot of work on the on our various activities on Taiwan's QDR. Then our friends at CSIS, Bonnie and Chris Johnson and Brittany Billingsley and Nicole White. Thank you very much. Phil mentioned the trip we did to Taiwan in December, and MND was very essential in facilitating that visit, and we appreciate that very much. Finally, please join me in thanking our two presenters, Colonel Chun and Dr. Saunders, and to Andrew for doing double duty. It's a very good session.